This is Edward McMillan. Yes, the Edward McMillan. The following is an encore presentation of Radio Parallax. It features an interview with one of our favorite guests, Stephen J. Harper, from a couple of years back. Sadly, it's still relevant today. This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Stephen J. Harper is a professor of law at Northwestern University. We've had him on this program three times previously to discuss, first, the epic mismanagement of the COVID pandemic, then the peculiar turns of recent national politics. Central to both discussions has been the figure of Donald J. Trump. Mr. Harper is well qualified to analyze Trump. He had previously put together a lengthy examination of the entire saga of Russia versus the Donald. This worthy document can be found at the websites of both Dan Rather and Bill Moyers. His work on the COVID epidemic and the bizarre way it was handled in the U.S. led to a series of timelines, which we hope will play a role in future legal accountings of Trump's actions. They, too, can be found on BillMoyers.com and are highly recommended by us. That Moyers site also contains an insightful analysis of the astonishing developments that characterize the final days of the Trump administration. At the head of the class in that category would be Stephen Harper's most recent posting, which summarizes where we are as impeachment begins. Relevant points include Trump's long-anticipated refusal to acknowledge any defeat in favor of absurdist claims of election fraud. Trump, of course, then led a campaign to change the results of the election by legal attacks. When that failed, he attempted to persuade officials in Georgia to simply find him enough votes to alter the outcome. Failing this, Trump attempted to have his vice president invalidate the electoral vote count. Facing the refusal of Mike Pence to attempt an obviously unconstitutional and legally meaningless action, Trump played his final hand on January 6th and incited an insurrection to stop the certification of the election and simply remain in power. The definition of a putsch is a secretly planned, suddenly executed attempt to overthrow a government. On January 6th, a putsch took place in Washington. In the wake of its failure, the House of Representatives voted to impeach Trump a second time. And so it is that this week the mandated trial in the U.S. Senate goes forward. As a law professor with deep knowledge of the defendant in the case, Stephen Harper is extremely qualified to render opinions on where this is likely to go. And believe you me, we seek those opinions. To obtain them, let's start by saying welcome back to Radio Parallax, Stephen Harper.
Thank you, Doug. I'm always happy to be here. One thing I would note for you. I'm actually an adjunct professor at Northwestern, and the reason for that is because my main job as a lawyer for 30 years was actually trying cases. What I do at Northwestern is teach trial practice courses and courses in ethics and professional responsibility. So in that sense, I feel, I guess, as if I have a little more to offer on the perspective of actually trying a case like this, maybe more than just a pure scholar approaching the subject might.
Sure.
What can I do for you today?
I want to start by directing listeners.
By the way, I should say, as we speak, the first day of the Senate trial is currently underway, and it's so your timing is perfect in that respect.
Yeah. For listeners, I should note that I'm here trying to work out the question I'm going to ask you. In the meanwhile, not being watched by me is MSNBC and CNN covering what's actually going on. So I'm coming in a little bit behind here, but we'll catch up.
That's okay. Yep.
It's a very succinct summary you're putting forward of these events that have taken place. I read it and I watched most of the attached videos, and I noted, first of all, CNN must have been looking at your site, because they were pretty much going down the script of what you had on their broadcast last night, and apparently, what really strikes a person, I think, is how incriminating the huge volumes of video shot that day are, which many of which you posted. And I guess here in the Senate chambers, they decided that would be a good thing to start with.
Yeah, I have to say, just from a standpoint of trial presentation, the House managers did what I thought was a superb job in their opening presentation. I've been watching the Trump lawyer, Bruce Castor, speak now for about half an hour. I don't know if it'll get better by the time he finishes. But at least to this point, I would guess that there's a client in Palm Beach in Mar-a-Lago who can't be particularly happy with what he's seeing. It's really stunning. But the videos tell the story. And in a case like this, there are lots of things that are important in terms of context. One of the important points of context, of course, is the 6 months of sort of revving up his base that Trump did in order to get them to a point where on January 6th, all he had to do was, you know, pick your favorite analogy, light the match or pull the trigger. The video that the House managers put together is a composite of the videos that I had put together as my proposed trial presentation if I were trying this case. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's must-see TV, and it's difficult to watch it in the sense that I still have a hard time believing that this happened in America.
Right.
And I have an even more difficult time accepting the notion that there will be enough Senate Republicans to just say, oh, well, give them a pass.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute.
Yep.
First of all, the thing they're trying to establish right now is there a right to even have this trial? And it looks like that's going to, I mean, Caster's not done talking. More Trump guys, as we speak, are going to, I guess, probably weigh in on the matter. But it seems pretty clear that the vote's going to go, yes, we have the right to do this.
Right. Yeah, he has. There's Bruce Caster, and then the other fellow whose name escapes me at the moment are the two lawyers he had. You may recall that, less than a week ago, all of the other lawyers that Trump had had to that point walked away from him. No one is 100% sure why, but the reporting is that Trump wanted his lawyers to continue to argue basically the false conspiracy claims that Trump has been trying to float out, you know, to sell and has apparently successfully sold to millions of his followers.
Yes.
He finally hit lawyers who said, no, you know what, I'm just not going to do that. I can't do that. After 4 years of having lawyers at his disposal who frankly refused to draw that kind of line,
right,
much to my chagrin, frankly, I wrote extensively and repeatedly about that, the problem of lawyers that had really lost their way. But these guys are arguing now, they're really down to the constitutional arguments, which are, well, I think they're frivolous. Frankly,
yeah.
And so do the majority of legal scholars. They boil down to a couple of really simple propositions. One is, you can't try a president because he's a former president, which is nonsense. The text and the House managers did a very good job on this, but the text, history, precedent, and everything else of the Constitution thoroughly rebuts that notion. Plus, they ignore the fundamental point that he's being impeached for what he did while he was president.
Yes.
And if you accept that notion, then you create what the House managers correctly call the January exception, which means that the president can be held to his oath of office for year one, year two, year three, and most of year four. But once you get to January, after he has lost an election, he can do everything in his power to try to hang on to power. And there's not anything that anyone can do about it, because by the time you get to trying him in the Senate, he won't be in office anymore, which is a crazy proposition. And then there are the other argument they make basically is that, there's a First Amendment. You know, Trump has as president, he had the First Amendment right to say what he said. And that is equally nonsense for a number of different reasons. But the most pithy of which is to say no president has a right to incite an insurrection against a coordinate branch of government,
sure,
namely the legislature, in an effort to stay in power. It seems self-evident, right?
You'd think. Well, meanwhile, the rioters are being put on trial. The defense that they're throwing up is that, well, they were doing what the president asked them to do. And so I guess we have to ask the question pretty on the early side, are those criminal cases likely to bleed over into these impeachment arguments? Because they're saying, look, Trump is just exercising free speech. He didn't really incite a riot. And the rioters are saying, oh, yes, he did.
Right. And we did it.
Yeah.
Right.
And we went out and did it.
They're going to bleed back and forth into each other. And I think that's going to happen for a long time to come. And the thing that you haven't yet seen in the private criminal cases that are being brought is what I would call the climb up the food chain. Where is all this coming from? Who are the real organizers of the rally? To what extent does this actually go back into Trump's White House in terms of the organization, in terms of all of the different aspects that led to the January 6th insurrection? I think that's going to be a very interesting story, and we already know enough to make things look, let's see, shall we say, suspect, given the number of former Trump campaign workers and pretty high up in his campaign staff and even in the White House who were, guess what, listed as organizers on the rally permit. You know, so I think this is going to lead in a lot of very ugly directions for Trump.
I'm a little unclear at how much evidence they're going to present, and whether Trump will testify. I don't know if you have a good sense of that, or how long the proceedings are likely to last. What do you think?
I don't think Trump will testify. There was an effort of an invitation, I should say, from the House managers to come and testify, which his lawyers immediately declined. The risk, of course, for Trump that his lawyers have seen going all the way back to when Mueller wanted to depose, take Trump's deposition, is once you get the guy under oath, he creates a whole new set of legal exposures for himself because he's just not capable of telling the truth consistently when it runs anywhere afoul of what he wants everyone to believe. How long will the trial take? You know, they've mapped out a schedule to this point that would take it into probably early next week. And the big question is, will the House managers seek to call witnesses? I sincerely hope they do. I think they can call witnesses and put witnesses on the stand, bring them in and have them testify without necessarily prolonging the trial all that long, because the witnesses you would call would be people like the U.S. Capitol officer who was getting, you know, crushed in the door as the rioters were hitting. It would be very short, pithy, pointed witnesses that really bring home the feeling of the you are there. You know, there was that old TV series, you know, you are there, and they'd reenact historical events. They'd play it as if it were a contemporary newscast. Well, all of America was there for this, and every single person in the Senate chamber was actually physically present and a witness and to some degree a victim of what happened that day.
Right.
So I really hope they do call witnesses, and to the extent that the Trump's lawyers want to call witnesses, my attitude would be, fine. I can't wait to see them. Give me an hour's notice so I can have a cross-examination ready, because I think it'll be pretty interesting, because I don't know what a live witness for Trump could possibly say. You know, they took an interesting position. In the brief that the Trump's lawyers filed, they took this position buried in a footnote that said, you know, the notion that Trump thought that what was happening was that he was delighted by it, which was a widespread reporting reflected that. The reason it took two hours or more to get focused on the need to mobilize the National Guard is because, reportedly anyway, Trump refused to do it. And then it goes on to say in this footnote, you know, he was horrified just like everyone else was, and there's no proof and there never will be any proof that he was delighted or promoted this or anything else. Well, it's baloney on a number of levels. Number one, we know he promoted it from his public statements. His very last tweet at 6:01 was, remember this day. You know, this is the kind of stuff that happens when, you know, elections get stolen from you. But more importantly, that footnote, to me, is an invitation to say, okay, fine, you say this is true, put on a witness. Let's have somebody testify to that. Because we know from Senator Ben Sasse, for example, who told Hugh Hewitt, who's been an ardent Trump defender all the way to the end, that he was in touch with the aides at the White House who said that Trump was delighted and he didn't understand why his aides weren't delighted with all the rioting that was happening and the response that was happening at the Capitol as it was happening. So, you know, I'd call Ben Sasse. There are a lot of interesting witnesses. I would call Mitch McConnell, who finally on the Senate floor said the mob was fed lies, you know, they were provoked by the president and other powerful people. Okay, well, put him on just put Mitch on the stand and just ask him if what he said was true. This is the key, I think, the way to think about this. The audience is, of course, it's the Senate, but the more important audience, I think, are the 75 million people who voted for Trump, because what you're ultimately trying to do is penetrate that cult.
Yes.
I have to believe that a number of that 75 million people who observed what happened on January 6th would not have voted for him on November 3rd after the events that they saw on January 6th. So it's some number. We already know it's some number less than 75 million. But those are the people that would be my target audience, my main target audience, which is why I was so pleased, frankly, that the House managers opened with a 20 or 30 minutes of really must-see TV. In the form of, here's what happened, and you were there, and your eyes weren't deceiving you. This is what happened. It was very, very well done, but it was very, very pointed, very clear, and you could not turn away.
Yeah, I was shocked to realize that it's highly probable that lots of people just never got around to seeing that footage. I hope that on the second go around with, you know, more publicity here in this impeachment trial, they'll finally get around to checking it out, because it's quite compelling.
Absolutely right. And the way they have sort of combined the different pieces, you know, there was a piece that Just Security did that showed the crowd, the reaction as Trump was speaking.
Yes.
Which, you know, it screams incitement to you.
Yeah, that's your first video on your page.
Right.
That's really
right.
Something.
Yep. Then there's the Washington Post, 41 minutes, that shows how they're marching through the Capitol buildings, and Eugene Goodman, the Capitol police officer, is diverting them away from Pence and the senators, you know, literally a minute after Pence had just escaped along that same corridor. And then you have the video of the mob attacking the officer, and then you have and even guys with body cams. And all of that, they've managed to merge all that together in a very good way that makes for a very powerful story. And I agree with you. I hope a lot of people get a chance to see it. You'd like to see it, at least half of it or something, on the news, every news channel. This is something that Americans really need to see.
I was holding up a copy I have here of your summary of what's happening. And there's one thing that's near the end of it that just sort of really jumps out at me that I don't think has gotten much attention anywhere. At 7 o'clock, Rudy Giuliani was trying to reach some of the senators to urge them on. And you've got a quote from what he said to them, like Senator Tuberville. He's trying to reach Tuberville, and I guess he reaches another senator, Senator Lee, whatever. Or he leaves a message saying, or should I say Coach Tuberville? This is Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer.
Right.
I'm calling
right.
because I want to discuss how we're going to do this. And at the end, here's the sentence that just blows me away. I know they're reconvening at 8 tonight, but the only strategy we can follow is to object to numerous states and raise issues so that we can get ourselves into tomorrow, ideally until the end of tomorrow. We have to speculate what was Giuliani and presumably Trump hoping would happen the next day if the chaos could continue along those lines for one more day.
Well, you're right. It is speculation, but you have to assume that at that point they're just playing a day-to-day game. So that if the goal is here's what I would speculate. I would speculate that the goal from November 6th on has always been to create sufficient doubt that there was a cloud over the election that cast very serious questions about its legitimacy. And so, you know, and we all know what the different things that Trump did to try to do that. He was calling election officials. He was calling governors. He was calling everybody in swing states, trying to get them just, you know, introduce a cloud, create a cloud, create uncertainty, create doubt. And I think the notion was if they could disrupt the process, and indeed that was what, if you think about what Cruz and Hawley, Senator Cruz, Ted Cruz, and Senator Josh Hawley were asking for when they were objecting on January 6th, they were asking that there be a delay during that 10-day time period, states go back and sort of check and audit and all that sort of stuff. So it was all about creating more doubt about the legitimacy of the election itself in a way that would then put Trump in a position to say, well, clearly there's got to be a great big do-over here, and at a minimum, we're going to have to rerun the election in swing state. And I just think it was all, you know, with Trump, it's always about get me to the next day.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was get me to a point where I can create sufficient doubt about this that there'll be some basis for me to do something else, and I'll figure out what the something else is tomorrow. But the game always is I got to stay in power, because once I'm not in power anymore, I got legal exposures all over creation on a whole host of issues, ranging from, you know, civil suits from women who claim they defamed them, to financial problems, to hundreds of millions of dollars that he owes Deutsche Bank, to on and on and on and on and on. To me, the interesting thing about the Giuliani call at 7 is that he reached Senator Lee by mistake. So he called Senator Lee of Utah intending to reach Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama. What's most interesting, and this is the part that I think has been kind of underappreciated, Giuliani used the same wrong number that Trump had used at 2 o'clock that afternoon,
yes.
As the riot is underway.
Yes.
Same wrong number, thinking he's reaching Tuberville, and he reaches Lee. 5 hours later, things are, you know, that was in the middle of the riot.
Right.
And at 2 o'clock, Trump is saying, you know, we need some time. You know, we don't know for sure what he said, but it's clear that the goal is to continue to object and create some time. So somehow Giuliani is using the same wrong number
Yes.
Reaches the same wrong guy. He thinks he's so charming, he leaves his voicemail. You know, maybe I should call you coach, you know, because you know, everybody loves America's mayor. You know, he's just such a charmer. That's the significant piece. They both use the same phone number and reach the thinking they were reaching the same guy, and they both reach the wrong guy.
Not a coincidence.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Since we're talking about the issue of what, you know, how there may have been a question of buying some time in this whole thing, I have to bring up the fact that in one of your compilation videos, it shows the National Guard troops outside of the building. I think CNN showed the same sequence. The sequencing in this implies that the National Guard's there before they resumed the electoral certification at 8 o'clock. But it seems clear if you look at it that it's the middle of the night and everybody's gone. There's nobody left on the steps when the National Guard's there. And it seems clear the building was actually cleared by then through the action of Special Weapons and Tactics Divisions of the FBI, Secret Service, and Municipal Police. So the great delay that appears to be present in the arrival of the National Guard, I think therein hangs a tale. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, oh, for sure. And that comes through loudly and clearly, even from the Department of Defense memo that was the first effort to sort of explain away any criticism that might come to the Department of Defense. The National Guard didn't show up until way later. The first of the National Guard people, other than a handful that had been assigned basically to monitor metro stations and not protect the Capitol, they didn't show up until, you know, hours later. In fact, I think that was Maryland and Virginia, which were the two states that came with their National Guard, weren't even there until one of them wasn't even there until the next morning.
Right. I think so one was at midnight, one's like the next morning.
That's right. So the only National Guard that came was ultimately not authorized, I think, until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it took time to mobilize them. So that the fact that it took the Department of Defense, because what happened was earlier on, Trump's acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, had issued this memo saying, look, nothing happens with the D.C. National Guard without my personal authorization.
Right.
Wasn't even giving them, you know, essential protective equipment. And even at that, it was a very small and limited staff that you know, sort of this SWAT team type strike force that they were going to have kind of ready nearby. And it took literally hours. Time that the D.C. mayor and the Capitol Police were pleading with the Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy and Miller to authorize the D.C. National Guard before Miller got around finally to authorizing it. And what's unusual, of course, and the reason that happened is because if D.C. were a state, the governor could have authorized it. But because D.C. is not a state, it has to be a federal government that authorizes the deployment of the National Guard. The mayor couldn't do it on her own. The Capitol Police couldn't do it on its own. But there's a story there. Yep.
Yeah.
It'll come out. I don't know exactly what it'll turn out to be. Maybe it's a story that turns out to be benign. Maybe it's innocuous. Maybe they were so concerned about the optics of what had happened in June with all the military brought out for that protest and the criticism that generated, that maybe they just were, you know, playing this one safer in the other direction. But I have to tell you, if you think about what would have happened on January 6th to that mob if instead of Trump supporters, it had been a bunch of multi-ethnic, multi-racial audience carrying Black Lives Matters, you know, posters or something else. I think they'd have been mowed down with machine guns.
Could be. I want to address another point that's seldom remarked upon. And in fact, I don't think anybody's remarked upon it. But in these videos, again, the ones that you presented and others have posted, it shows that when the congressional staffers were being evacuated, they passed very close to the rioters. They really had this thin blue line of police between them and the insurrectionists. Apparently, some of those staffers had with them the actual electoral ballots. And I want to raise the question of, what if those had been seized by the insurrectionists? They would have not have been able to, Pence could not have regaveled the proceedings back to order at 8 o'clock if the ballots were missing.
That's right. I think that's exactly correct. Were there copies of the electoral ballot? I mean, I don't know enough about the logistics of how that process works, but that would have been the ultimate disruption, right? Assuming the original copies of the electoral votes were the ones that would be required for certification, I mean, that would have really thrown everything into haywire. So credit the quick thinking staffers who grabbed those and secured them and saved them, because I mean, I don't know. Maybe there was some simple backup and it wouldn't have been a big deal. But I don't know. You couldn't assume that. At the time that happened, there were a number of people that commented, well, good quick thinking on their part. So it must have been that it would have been significant. Some of that mob, they wouldn't even have known what they'd had, I think, if they'd come across them.
We need to take a break at this point. You're listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett.